From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
Our first guest today is Paul Burnett. Paul is Trout Unlimited's project coordinator for the area and also the chair of the East Canyon Creek Watershed Committee. He's here today to talk about Trout Unlimited and their work in our area, including their projects on Fish Passage.
Great. And after that, Park City's Temple Har Shalom recently installed some solar panels on the temple roof. We'll speak with Lynn Suchsdorf, executive director at Temple Har Shalom, about how the system is doing, how much electricity they're generating, and why they decided to install a solar system.
After that, roughly 60% of daily U.S. energy consumption goes to powering commercial and industrial buildings. And almost 30% of that consumption is wasted by leaving lights on, appliances running, and HVAC systems heating and cooling spaces inefficiently.
GridPoint is a company which provides software-based management tools that can reduce that wasted energy and, of course, save money and benefit the environment at the same time.
Dave Cantor is with GridPoint, and he joins us later in the show to discuss the company and their product.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. And it all gets started right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
Join us for Cool Science Radio Thursdays at 9 a.m.
From the discovery of new dinosaurs to the science of an avalanche.
From the secret technology behind Facebook to nanotechnology.
Deciphering science and tech in an entertaining, amusing, and accessible way.
It's Cool Science Radio. If we understand it, so can you.
Thursdays at 9 a.m. only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Peak Art and Frame.
Spring cleaning, moving, remodeling, donate your gently used construction materials and household items to the Restore, your local home improvement reuse store today. Visit habitat-utah.org to see our list of accepted items or call 435-487-9015 to learn how to donate to the Restore. Your donation helps keep thousands of tons of materials out of the waste stream and generates revenues for Habitat's affordable housing programs. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a local nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson, and across the board is Chris Cherniak. And on the phone with us this morning is Paul Burnett with Trout Unlimited. Paul is the project coordinator for Trout Unlimited and also the chair of the East Canyon Creek Watershed Committee. So he is an expert on all things native fish and local water quality, and he's here to talk with
Not
us today.
Not just trout?
Not just trout.
Oh, so we can talk. It's still
yeah, we can get a little bit broader.
Perfect.
That's right.
All right.
So, Paul, thanks for joining us.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me this morning. I'm happy to be here.
So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about Trout Unlimited as an organization? It's nationwide, right?
Yeah, that's correct. We're a nationwide cold water conservation organization, and we're a nonprofit organization, and our mission is to conserve, protect, and restore North America's cold water fisheries and their watersheds. And I am on staff with Trout Unlimited, and I coordinate our what we call a Home Rivers initiative here in the Weber River Basin.
And can you describe to us where the Weber River Basin is? So parts of Summit County are in that, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Actually, the most of the headwaters of the Weber River come out of Summit County, and the main stem of the Upper Weber, as well as Chalk Creek and East Canyon Creek as well. So Summit County is a pretty critical component of the Weber River watershed. The Weber River is the third largest tributary to the Great Salt Lake Basin, behind the Bear River and the Provo, so it's kind of sandwiched in between those two other basins, and it's a pretty major contributor to the Great Salt Lake, as well as a major supply of water for most of us on the Wasatch Front. So,
when was Trout Unlimited formed, and what was perhaps the impetus for its formation?
So we were formed in 1959 in Michigan. And really the impetus at that time was trying to improve conditions for wild trout. So there was kind of a group of anglers at the time who were really interested in trying to preserve these wild trout populations in Michigan, and that movement grew to a nationwide movement over time. So now we have about 100,000 members of our organization, grassroots members, as well as about 300 staff across the U.S.
Wow. That's a big organization.
Well, I take it that's because there's a lot of issues associated with trout and other fisheries.
Yeah, certainly.
I mean, obviously, it's not just water quality. It can be sometimes water quantity, water management, and supply.
Yeah, it really depends on the geography that you're located. I can really speak specifically on the Weber Basin. There are a lot of different issues that, as an organization, we try to tackle. And really, the key behind our organization is we're composed of anglers who are really interested in giving back to our rivers and watersheds. By protecting our habitats, restoring and reconnecting habitats, as well as kind of sustaining a movement of protecting the watershed. So, so in the Weber Basin, the primary impacts are kind of past and present. You know, the Weber River's been impacted for a long time by land management, by flood control, and the construction of roads and railroads. And then at the same time, there's also quite a bit of what we call habitat fragmentation. So basically, habitat that the fish need across the watershed is chopped up into smaller pieces by things like road crossings and irrigation diversions and impoundments and that sort of thing. So what we try to do as an organization is, at least locally, is try to look at these sources of degradation and try to strategically restore different areas of the watershed based on our capacity. So as staff, I can help kind of coordinate some of the larger like fish passage projects and restoration projects, and then I can coordinate and collaborate with our grassroots members to help with some of the other components of those projects, like the outreach and the education, as well as things where we need a lot of people to help, like willow plantings and bank stabilization with like revetments and that sort of thing.
So do you have other staff here in Utah with Trout Unlimited, or is it just you?
In Utah, we have 5 full-time staffers. There are 2 people across the state that do our watershed restoration. So, and we have 2 watershed programs, one in the Bear River, which is really focused on the native trout in the Bear River, Bonneville cutthroat trout, and then my program here in the Weber River, which is more focused on kind of a grassroots engagement, as well as Bonneville cutthroat trout conservation and a species called the bluehead sucker. And then we have 3 other members who primarily work in the policy arena, so looking at leasing in-stream flows and also working with landowners to help landowners improve things like grazing and that sort of thing, where we can develop these kind of cooperative projects to improve the watershed as well as improve the conditions for the producer.
Now, you mentioned one native trout species, the Bonneville cutthroat. Are there other native trout species? And the second part is, what are non-native trout species?
If we talk specifically about the Weber River, the Bonneville cutthroat trout is the only native trout to the area. There's also the mountain whitefish, which is a salmonid, which is in the same family as trout, and that's also, the mountain whitefish is also a native fish to the Weber River. So we kind of prop these two trout species or these two salmonid species. It's kind of on a higher level in terms of conservation. across the state, there are actually three native species or subspecies of cutthroat trout. The Yellowstone cutthroat trout, there's a small sliver of northwestern Utah that they occur in the Raft River drainage. And then within the Bonneville Basin, so it includes like Bear River, the Weber River, Provo, and the Sevier River, the Bonneville cutthroat trout occur. And then in the Colorado Basin, the Colorado River cutthroat are the native cutthroat.
Right.
Within that basin.
Okay, so the brown and the rainbow that I catch in the middle Provo are non-native. They're basically introduced species.
That's correct. They're introduced species, but they do have a pretty major social value. So
okay.
So just because they're not native, it doesn't mean they're not important.
Okay. Right.
And it just means that, there's different management strategies that, we would place on habitat restoration and priorities and that sort of thing. So they're definitely all valuable and they can conflict with each other. That's where we really play a role with working with agencies such as the DWR and helping them with management of the habitats for these species.
So are these non-native species stocked? How do they get into our rivers and streams?
Well, a lot of the rainbow trout are stocked primarily in the reservoirs, and so there is some escapement out of those reservoirs into some of the streams. I believe, at least in northern Utah, most of the rainbow trout that are stocked have been sterilized, so they can't reproduce, which is a benefit for the cutthroat trout. So we can have the social value of being able to collect or being able to catch the rainbow trout, but they won't conflict with cutthroat as much. The brown trout were stocked for many years in a lot of our rivers, and then most of them have established kind of a naturalized wild population that is self-sustaining.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Paul Burnett. He's a project coordinator with Trout Unlimited, and he works here locally in Utah, and what is the health of the trout population in the state generally?
Generally speaking, I would say that the trout populations are in pretty good shape in the state. Really depends on where you go, geographically. There are obviously a lot of challenges in Utah, to keep water in streams so that we can grow big fish, and that's kind of one of the big areas where we're working on is trying to protect some of the in-stream flows for these really high priority trout populations. It really depends on where we are. In many places in the Weber River, they're doing really well. In many other places across the state, they're overall they're doing pretty good, and there's a lot of opportunities for people to enjoy the recreational aspects of the trout.
Right.
So you mentioned that one of the challenges right now is fish passage. Like their habitat is kind of chopped up by diversions or dams or who knows what. What are you guys doing to address that issue?
Well, one of the first things that we've been trying to do, speaking specifically about the Weber River and East Canyon Creek, is really trying to figure out where all these different what we call barriers are. So barriers are basically, something that's some sort of structure that's in the stream that blocks fish from moving upstream, and that has an impact on the resiliency of the fish population. So the more chopped up a system is, the more at risk the fish populations are to being lost due to things like a fire or a flood or a dewatering or something like that. So if we can reconnect larger networks of stream habitats, then the fish population within that network is more resilient to those sorts of impacts to the watershed. So really, the first thing we've been trying to do is really identify where all these sites are across the basin, and we did that over the last couple of years, and in the Weber Basin. So that includes, you know, the entire main stem of the Weber and all of its tributaries in the Ogden River. There's about 200 complete fish migration barriers.
Wow.
That's pretty major of an impact. And if you think about it in terms of, like, okay, well, what are we going to do about all these? In terms of actually getting projects on the ground, like fish passage projects, realistically, we can do 3 to 4 a year. So if you start doing the math, it really becomes a daunting challenge. So it really requires us to kind of strategize where we're going to be doing these fish passage projects. So we're really trying to focus on the strongholds for the cutthroat trout and for the bluehead sucker specifically. Those are kind of the more at-risk species within the Weber River Basin.
So is there anything to prevent further barriers from going into a stream? Is there, you know, are there rules now that don't allow this to happen anymore?
There are not specific rules. There are ways for us to engage when people are, you know, building new roads or rebuilding diversions where we can help prevent the construction of barriers. And typically what we end up doing is when we engage, we try to develop it as a partnership, so we're not, you know, so it doesn't appear that the fish interests or the watershed interests are in conflict with other interests within the watershed, because that tends to be a little more controversial and a little more difficult to get things done. So when we engage, we try to be collaborative with our efforts and trying to help, you know, project sponsors develop projects that are more fish passable, basically, where it's critical.
So how do you decide which of these 200 to start with? Seems like a daunting task.
Yeah, no, that's a major challenge. And so when I say we, you know, Trout Unlimited, we're kind of part of a broader partnership within the Weber Basin. And what we have decided to do is we really need to look at this strategically. And so, as a broad partnership, we developed a strategic plan for the basin to look at kind of the different challenges that we face within the watershed. So, I mean, fish passage is just one thing. I mean, if we look at East Cannon Creek, there's a whole lot of different issues, such as water quality and quantity. And so, so balancing all those is important. But in terms of fish passage, what we've really landed on is we really want to prioritize the really high-value cutthroat populations, and then where those high-value cutthroat trout populations overlap with the bluehead sucker, which is also another high-value species within the watershed. Those are kind of the areas where we're really focusing on fish passage. So Chalk Creek, for example, is a good example, as well as what we call the Middle Weber River, which flows into the Weber River near Mountain Green, basically from Morgan downstream to about Ogden. There's a pretty good stronghold of cutthroat trout, and that overlaps with bluehead sucker.
Hey, Paul, we got a couple minutes left.
Sure.
You're talking about these barriers. You know, the obvious ones come to mind, bridges and other man-made structures, but might that also include beavers and beaver dams, or do they serve as a barrier to or a challenge to trout populations?
They can be a challenge, but there's actually some recent research out there by Utah State that suggests that they are actually not a barrier to native fish. Native fish have figured out how to get through beaver dams.
Hmm.
So that's a good thing, because beavers really do benefit the watersheds if we can keep them there.
Right. And we have a lot of beaver fans out there.
Chris is pointing at me. A ton of beaver fans in the studio right now.
Exactly. So
hey, I work in water quality. You can't blame me.
No, but trout are very finicky with respect to temperature, and beaver dams can create situations where water temperatures rise and and that's bad for trout habitat.
Not necessarily.
Well, no?
Yeah, it's interesting because the beaver dams will actually cause more hyporheic exchange, so basically shallow groundwater exchange between the stream and the groundwater, and that groundwater is colder, so it'll actually maintain colder temperatures and buffer temperatures in the winter. So so there are definitely a lot of benefits from beavers, for sure.
Oh, yep. Good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Paul, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. Where can people go to learn more about Trout Unlimited and your work?
If you're interested in learning more about Trout Unlimited, you can just go to www.tu.org. And then we also have, there's obviously a Facebook page, several Facebook pages, one which is Utah Trout Unlimited. The other is just our main Trout Unlimited. You can just search Trout Unlimited. And then we have a couple of chapters that people could follow, Weber Basin Anglers as well as the High Country Anglers.
Perfect. Well, thanks again, Paul, for joining us. Now I know more about the relationship between trout and beavers. Who knew?
That's right.
Thanks,
Paul. It's a win-win-win.
Exactly. Win-win.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you, Kristen. Thank you.
Let's take a break for a couple of underwriters. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Lynn Suksdorf of Temple Har Shalom about their new solar roof-mounted solar system.
They're going up all over town. It's exciting.
And it's all faith-based.
That's right.
It's This Green Earth. We'll be back right after these words from our underwriters. Stay tuned.
Foothill Oriental Rugs has been an underwriter on KPCW for over 20 years. I'm Jim Weber, owner, rug buyer, and Park City resident. As a direct importer since 1985, from traditional to contemporary to tribal, Foothill Oriental Rugs is Utah's complete rug source. Foothill Oriental Rugs is located 2 miles north of the mouth of the canyon in Salt Lake City at 1460 Foothill Drive.
This is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage service provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW. Summit County residents are recycling more and more each year in their residential curbside recycling bin. Please help by putting acceptable recyclables in and keeping glass out. Thank you, Summit County. SummitCountyRecycles.org.
Rocky Mountain Power is proud to support KPCW and This Green Earth. Rocky Mountain Power Watt Smart New Homes Program offers incentives for building a new energy-efficient home that can help you enjoy year-round comfort, higher resale value, and lower energy bills. To learn more or find a builder in your area, wattsmart.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, weekly talk show on environmental issues, our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak. She's Nell Larson. And joining us in studio is Lynn Suksdorf. He is the executive director at Temple Har Shalom here in Park City. And he's here to talk all about their new, brand new solar system.
Yes.
That they have installed at the temple. It's a bit up and running. Lynn, thanks for taking the time to chat with Nell and me.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here this morning. We're very proud of this effort and the Blue Sky Project and our participation. So,
yeah, give us a little background on the system.
And how long you've been up and running.
Yeah.
The system was actually installed after Sundance in February. And so we had the system went live in March, and April was our first full month of operation. And so we're just kind of getting into it, but it is producing energy, and so it's a good thing.
Good. How big is it? How many panels?
We have 36 panels on the roof, not as large as the grant we applied for, but our goal, of course, that's always the case, but our goal is to apply again, which we can do, and expand the panels so that we can get better coverage.
Fantastic.
And is there a reason why 36? Is that a factor of 18?
That's interesting, Chris, that you'd mention that, because in the Jewish faith, 18 and 36 are, you know, it's the kind of double high kind of thing.
Okay.
But it's actually what the grant allowed.
but interesting it just coincidence.
It is a coincidence that it happened to fit into this religious significance.
Okay. So I thought there was a faith-based okay.
There is. And it's a significant number. So it was maybe there's some faith in the number of panels we received.
So next stop, not necessarily 54.
no, I'll take whatever we can get.
But you got 36 up there.
Yes.
How much? What was the design energy for that?
Well,
for
what we're getting produced. I have our first full monthly report. In April, we actually produced 1.34 megawatts of energy, which you know, in a carbon offset situation, that's equivalent to over a ton of coal.
Yeah.
The actual number is 2,048 pounds of coal.
Good.
And so that's quite an offset, you know. So it is producing.
Is that what you were anticipating? Is that what the design was?
Once we received the grant and found out what the design would be, we learned that this would be kind of the output, slightly higher as the weather improves and we get more sunny days. But this is what we're anticipating for the installation we have. The goal would be to cover our roof and meet, you know, a far greater percentage of our energy demand.
So you still have more room.
Yeah, yes. And our panels are a little different than you see on other churches. There are three religious organizations that receive solar panels under this grant this year. And ours are low profile. We have a flat roof rather than a pitched roof at Temple Har Shalom. And for those that don't know, it's on the right of Highway 224, right across from St. Mary's. And we sit down in kind of a draw. But there's only one point that you can see the panels from 224.
Mm-hmm.
They're a low profile, low angle, self-cleaning, of course, in the wintertime. But so they're not, you know, hanging on the roof.
Right.
As blatantly
available.
They're not
as prominent
right.
as but Shepherd of the Mountains.
Exactly
the roof,
right.
Roof,
yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of. And so it's not they're there. They fit in. They're not a visual obstruction, and yet we're getting the benefit, and it's a great system.
Oh, absolutely.
So how did the decision to install these solar panels come about? You know, was this something that you led the charge, or the congregation as a whole kind of thought, we want to commit to this?
We had an interim executive director, Brian Kahn, who worked with Energy Solutions to developed the grant request last year. I came in the end of June of last year as the permanent executive director, and so the grant application was already done at that point. However, I would say that in the Jewish faith, there's a component of environmental stewardship of the earth, and so it fits into that religious component of the Jewish faith that is part of the stewardship that we have over the planet Earth. It's not it's part of that idea that you do what you can to make a greener world, to keep it going into the future. And so it fits into that religious social responsibility connection of the Jewish faith. So that's part of it. And then also, I mean, living in Park City and being part of – most of our congregants move here because of the lifestyle of Park City. And we have congregants from all over the country who have either moved here permanently or are second homeowners. Many of them have installed solar panels on their homes. So it's that mindset that you do what you can to aid in that push. And it goes right along with Park City and all of that.
What was the size of the grant? How much did the system cost to install?
Originally, we had applied for a larger grant, but we received $35,000, and that paid for the entire installation, all of the panels, and all of the wiring, all of the connectivity to Rocky Mountain Power. And all of that. So the 36 panels, including installation, cost $35,000. That's the grant we received. So it didn't cost us anything. The grant paid for it all, which is really nice.
And what are your ongoing costs? Sorry, I mean, are there any ongoing O&M costs with
the solar system? There will be some. It's so new that right now there's nothing related.
Good, right.
You know, it's just up and running. There with Rocky Mountain and the Blue Sky Project, you sign on to a certain block of Blue Sky Energy.
Yeah.
And that's a bit more expensive than normal rates for electricity. But the energy produced offsets much of that.
Right.
And so we're just getting the numbers down to kind of figure out the relationship between what we're producing, what we're paying, what are the benefits. The return on investment for this, from a normal standpoint, most people anticipate 10 to 15 years. We're estimating about 10 to 12 years.
Right.
If we were to look at not having the grant and doing this kind of an installation ourselves, if that makes sense.
Right. So having that the grant is a huge financial boost long term.
Oh, huge benefit. And as we increase the solar panels on the roof, then our energy production will be greater and our actual energy costs will go down over time as we continue to do this. We are approaching this coming year. Our year runs July to June. And this next year, part of our fundraising campaign among our congregation is the opportunity to actually buy panels for the temple to increase our solar panel array. And then with a second application to Rocky Mountain Power for another grant and community involvement in adding more, we hope that over the next few years we'll be able to complete the full array that we would like on that roof and literally occupy the roof.
Fantastic. In addition to it's generating energy, it's offsetting some cost, it's protecting the environment, it serves as an educational opportunity.
Absolutely right. One of the things that I love about the grant is that we have a monitor that is installed in the building.
Right.
And we turn that on when we have guests or an event, and people can actually see in real time the production of the energy that's being produced by the solar array. And then it also gives an over time graphic display.
Right.
Plus it literally, the display that we have currently talks about the number of pounds of coal that are displaced by the solar panel. And much of the, as we know, energy production here is mostly coal and natural gas,
mm-hmm.
both carbon fuels.
Right.
And so if we can take that out. Help to take that out, the better off we will be. So it's a learning tool for our religious school students and for people visiting the temple.
Right.
I was just going to ask if this is something that the public community can come in and see.
Well, they can't climb around our roof, but we do have photos of the arrays that are there. They can see the panel. We can talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're a Sundance venue during the Sundance Film Festival, and Sundance has a green initiative, as you know, with recycling and green energy. And so it's part of that, and the monitor will be on during the entire film festival to demonstrate to people what we're doing for energy conservation as well as green energy production.
That's wonderful.
That's fantastic. So any other environmentally related programs or projects the temple has or plans to do?
Well, as we're moving forward, we're trying to – of course, we have some wetlands on our lot there.
Right.
We run along the stream. So we're working with the county and with other organizations on water, clean water issues. We have taken measures in the building for water conservation.
Mm-hmm.
We monitor our water use. And we've installed light switches that are geared to detect motion. And
right.
So if someone's not in the room and they forget to turn off the switch, the lights go off.
Right.
And so all of this combined, and as more technology, more things come available, we will keep adding more, you know, because we think that it's part of our responsibility as humans on the earth.
Again, like you touched on earlier that kind of the moral obligation that we have to protect and care for the planet and its natural resources.
Yes.
I mean,
and to think of the future, you know,
exactly.
The idea that we may be gone, but this will continue, you know,
and
there's a responsibility we feel to leave it better for our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren.
Right, and we've had on representatives from Interfaith Power and Light talking the larger issue with, you know, all religious foundations or organizations looking at that, reflecting upon that responsibility, that care that's required. And we're, Nell and I, are, you know, we're encouraged by what we see and read about more and more religious organizations understanding the importance of that and then teaching their congregations about that.
Well, I think that's a key part, Chris, is then you become the example for your congregations.
Yeah.
Irrelevant of faith. It's the idea that you become the example of what can be done even on a smaller scale, but that anyone can participate and take that level of consciousness a little higher.
Yeah.
Think of the community. Think of the future.
Yeah. Right. And you guys are creating a solar row.
Well, the churches are leading the way on 224.
And that's, absolutely.
And that's it. Next thing, maybe the barn at your house now.
Yeah, if we can power my house with the solar panels, I'll apply for a grant.
All you need to do is become a religious organization in some form.
Well, and actually there are grants.
And then they'll fund us.
Yeah, well, there are grants available for homeowners, I understand, as
well.
Oh,
yeah, they're out there.
You don't necessarily have to become a religious organization in and of yourself.
No. That's right. And, you know, maybe I'll mention right now while we're at it, I know that the University of Utah is running a bulk solar program right now for individuals that are affiliated with the university or fans of the university.
Yes.
So that's something to look into if you're interested.
Yes. One of the things that, I mean, I teach as an adjunct at the U in the David Eccles School of Business. And thank you for the plug. I appreciate that.
Unintended, but that's perfect.
The university is even looking at solar arrays above, like, bus waiting stations, parking areas, you know, panels around the university. The engineering school's looking at, you know, some issues with water drainage and water conservation and reuse. And so the university is doing some good things as well. And they do have the solar initiative. So, you know, it's a great thing.
Fantastic.
The state's getting on board.
Well,
yeah.
Lynn Sukstorff, he's the executive director at Temple Har Shalom. We really appreciate you taking the time to come down here and chat with us about your solar system, and we'll stay in touch and see how things continue to perform now that we're finally probably getting into the even sunnier days.
That's right. As we drive down 224, we'll crane our necks toward the Temple Har Shalom see if we can get a peek of this.
Or stop by. And this has been a pleasure. I look forward to coming back.
All right.
Thanks for coming.
Lynn. Hey, let's take another break for a few underwriters. When we come back, we'll be speaking with Dave Cantor. GridPoint is the company. They produce hardware and software-based management tools for energy efficiency. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
This is Chris Robinson with Prudential Utah Real Estate, and we've been supporting KPCW since day one. Prudential Utah helps buyers and sellers with their home needs, whether it's a condo, single-family house, or undeveloped land. Our agents know our community and our local market. More information can be found at pru-utah.com.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Spring cleaning, moving, remodeling, donate your gently used construction materials and household items to the Restore, your local home improvement reuse store today. Visit habitat-utah.org to see our list of accepted items or call 435-487-9015 to learn how to donate to the Restore. Your donation helps keep thousands of tons of materials out of the waste stream and generates revenues for Habitat's affordable housing programs. Habitat for Humanity of Summit and Wasatch Counties is a local nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, weekly talk show here on KPCW, all about environmental issues, our relationship with and impacts upon the environment. She's Nell Larson. I'm Chris Cherniak. And joining us in the studio is Dave Cantor. He is with GridPoint. Basically, they're a company which produces and provides hardware and software-based management tools for energy efficiency, electricity. We're speaking.
That's right.
And we're going to learn, spend a few minutes, and learn all about what GridPoint is and how it's applied. Dave, first, thanks for joining Nell and myself on This Green Earth.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So why don't we have Dave give us kind of the overview of what GridPoint is?
Sure, be happy to do that. GridPoint is a, as Chris mentioned, an energy management company based in Arlington, Virginia. Basically, what the company does is we work with a variety of different kinds of clients, primarily commercial clients. We do some government work as well, and we have a kind of a three-tiered system. One is trying to control energy inside a building. The other part of the system would be to develop some submetering, granulated data, and then we have a services side of the business that helps these companies really take advantage of all of our systems to save money and save energy effectively.
Right.
So explain what you mean by submetering and granulated data.
Sure, be happy to. So what submetering is basically is that most commercial type enterprises have some form of a control set on their buildings, meaning that they set the temperatures for the HVAC, the HVAC systems, you know, when they go on, when they go off. And what we do is that we sort of layer on top of those building control systems, and we can monitor and meter the energy coming into the building. We can meter and monitor also the different areas inside of a building that is using energy. And then that data is then driven to our data center, and we have analysts that are looking at it, being able to really, really evaluate what's going on inside a building on a real-time basis. And that gives the owners of any type of property the opportunity to really, really make good decisions in terms of trying to drive their energy costs down.
Right. So not just like on a day in, is this an hour or minute-by-minute basis of how much electricity I might be consuming in my HVAC, with my lighting, with my refrigeration?
Exactly. When I say granulated data, we can actually monitor on a minute-by-minute basis. So we consider it real-time. You really know what's going on inside your building on a real-time basis. And so you can make good decisions on a proactive basis as opposed to reactive. So it actually helps owners in managing their assets. We can determine if power is coming into the building in what we call high quality or low quality. Low quality power means that the equipment is going to be working too hard, and it will, you know, it will really drive the life of that equipment down. Mm-hmm. It will affect the comfort levels inside a building, and we can identify, you know, what's happening on a real-time basis and report back to the building owners so they can make good decisions about, you know, keeping their equipment working properly.
So can you give us an example or two of companies that you work with and what you've been able to help them do?
Sure, be happy to. So probably our largest client is Target, which is based in Minneapolis. There's 1,800 of them.
Wow.
And we have our submetering solution in all 1,800. And Target is probably one of, if not the most sophisticated energy management systems and companies in the country, if not in the world. They've got a staff of 80 people looking at energy inside their buildings at all times.
Wow.
Another example is the U.S. Post Office is a client of ours, too.
Yeah.
So we help them with their submetering solution so they can identify issues that are going on inside their building. So typically in submetering is we can drive the cost down anywhere from 3% to 10%. Doesn't sound like a lot, but these, you know, you're talking about thousands of buildings throughout the country.
Massive buildings.
Yeah, massive buildings that are using a lot of energy. And so it becomes quite significant to the, you know, to our clients. So not only are we saving them money, but the fact is that they're using less energy, which is also good for the environment too.
Right, right. I mean, Target is committed to it. If they have dozens and dozens of people whose only job is to manage energy, they see the value of that, not only from a cost perspective, but from a environmental perspective. But then, you know, there's that branding thing too. Target wants to be a champion of environmental responsibility, and you know, let's be fair, let's be honest. It's a nice way to showcase them.
Yeah, absolutely. They feel like many of our clients that they're part of the community and that they are setting an example for the rest of the community. So it becomes sort of a two-pronged benefit. Not only are they saving money, but they're also, you know, doing good things for the environment.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know how long you've been with GridPoint, but I'm curious if you've seen a trend in more companies wanting to take advantage of a service like this, or an increase in interest in reducing their energy bills and their energy usage.
Yeah, there's no question that it's becoming front and center to many businesses, and I think it's for two reasons. One, statistically, if you look at all the data that's coming out, energy cost are going up on the average of about 2% a year,
right.
and that's before tax dollars. So that becomes quite significant to businesses. And then again, as Chris had mentioned, and I had reiterated that not only is it all about saving money, but it's also about becoming part of a movement inside this country that is really taking a hard look at, you know, carbon footprinting and issues that are, you know, significant to the environment.
Right. Well, the research we did showed that on average 30% of electricity consumed by commercial buildings, industrial buildings, is wasted, inefficient. So there's, like you said, there's lots of opportunity.
Correct.
In most buildings today to stop you know, burning coal but stop writing a check to Rocky Mountain Power.
Right.
You know, exactly. And that's an interesting statistic. And again, that's not coming from GridPoint. That's coming from research by the U.S. government that typically inside a commercial building, 30% of all energy is wasted. And so what we try to do is find where that waste is.
Yeah.
And help the building owners and the business owners get their arms around it. So not only is it going to be saving them money, but again, it's they're not going to be using energy they don't need to use.
So where often is that energy that people are wasting?
So the majority of it is really coming from what we call HVAC, which is really the heating and cooling systems inside a building. So to give you an example, a building might have controls set at a certain temperature, but it really doesn't take into account occupied and unoccupied space. So meaning if a building or a business closes down at 5 o'clock, a lot of situations where that temperature will stay whatever the occupied space was that they had set the temperatures for. So why would you want to have a building that 72 degrees if nobody is inside that building? And so what we can do is we can move that temperature up to what we call an unoccupied set point. And then we have what are called dynamic recoveries, meaning that an hour or two prior to the business opening, we can gradually turn the systems on so that it gets to an occupied space. And that's an important point, because if you turn your systems off and then all of a sudden you turn them all back on all at the same time, it's really using up a lot of energy and it's putting a strain on the equipment. So what our systems can do is it can sort of turn them on in levels, you know, a little bit at a time. So when the business opens, everything is comfortable and ready to go, but it hasn't put an extraordinary amount of strain on the equipment and it's keeping the cost down too.
Well, obviously, you know, your product, your services, they're not free. There's a cost, but your clients recognize again that it's well worth the money spent for the potential savings that they get out of your systems and your services.
Correct. So our business model is sort of based on two factors. One would be direct savings, which would be, you know, driving energy cost. And then we have a variety of what we call indirect savings, and that would be operational efficiencies and capital expenditure efficiencies too. So on the average, we can save a business anywhere from, on the low end, 4-5% up to 30% on their energy cost. But then you can't really put a number on the indirect savings, but oftentimes that can be even larger than the direct savings. And that would be, you know, extending the life of the equipment, operational type of savings that businesses have a way of defining that you really can't put a dollar figure on, but sometimes that can be even more significant.
So you often work with these really large companies. Do you also work with smaller businesses, maybe somebody that just has one facility?
We do. We would work with typically we work with hospitals that might have one, you know, facilities.
Sure.
We might work with office buildings that own one big building. We are not geared towards the residential market, though that is becoming a very significant part of where energy management is going. I had mentioned to Chris yesterday when I saw him that Google just purchased a company that is really geared towards energy management at the residential level. So their system will be able to do something very similar to ours, but really more, you know, geared towards the home.
Right.
Interesting.
Right. Well, Dave, where can people go to learn more about GridPoint?
Best place to go would be our website. It's gridpoint.com.
Simple enough.
And they can learn quite a bit about who we are, what we do, and some of the benefits that we provide.
And maybe contact you?
Certainly, they could contact me. I live here, right here in Park City. So my email address is davecantor@gridpoint.com.
All right.
So feel free to contact me. Love to share any information we can and educate anybody that's interested.
All right, Dave. Dave Cantor with GridPoint. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us. Learn a lot more about energy efficiency hardware and software systems.
Well, thanks so much. It's a pleasure being here.
All right. Let's take one last break for some underwriters, and we'll come back and wrap up. It's This Green Earth. Stay tuned.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Brett Stimson, Mortgage Assistant for Home Purchases, 801-201-3484. Low Stump Tree Service, Park City's Local Tree Care, 435-200-5730. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. It's time to wrap up
another show.
Great show.
But
let's first thank our underwriters for whom this show would not be possible. They include Republic Services,
Habitat for Humanity's Restore,
Vail Resorts,
Rocky Mountain Power,
San Francisco Design,
and Prudential Utah Real Estate.
Of course, you can always join us and like us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth.
And we always welcome your thoughts, ideas, comments at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Perfect. Hey, I got one last minute, one plug. I'm going to be attending the breakfast fundraiser for Heal Utah tomorrow. And Michael Mann, Penn State University, a scientist climatologist, is going to be speaking there.
This is like the climatologist of the hockey stick graph.
The hockey stick
graph.
Absolutely.
Big science nerd here.
They snagged him, and I'm looking forward to sitting in on that. Maybe I can do my best to try to grab him or someone from Heal to talk to us next week.
We've interviewed Michael Mann in the past, in 2013. Maybe we'll get him back on.
All right. That's the deal. That's it. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you all next week. NPR News is next. Remember, this is KPCW 91.9 FM, Park City. Only in Park City, only on KPCW.